Hey everybody, welcome to another Ithaca Bound podcast episode. I'm your host, Andrew Schiestel, and this is the podcast where we explore history and mythology in the Mediterranean Basin. I'm joined today with Dr. Gavin Kelly for a conversation about the life and writings of Cornelius Tacitus, known to most in contemporary terms as simply Tacitus. Tacitus was a Roman historian and politician who lived during the Roman Principate era, so the early Roman Empire, and is considered to most scholars as one of, if not the greatest, of Roman historians. So in the conversation today, Dr. Kelly and I are going to speak more about Tacitus's life and writings, and I'm sure we'll get at why he's considered one of, if not the greatest, Roman historian. Dr. Kelly is a professor in the Department of Classics at the University of Edinburgh, based in Scotland. He's the author of numerous publications, including co-authoring the book Two Romes, Rome and Constantinople in Late Antiquity, which was published by Oxford University Press. And he joins us today from the UK. Welcome to the call, Gavin.
Very nice to be here, Andrew.
All right, so who was Tacitus?
Well, as you said, Tacitus is a Roman historian and politician, and he's the person that most literary and historical judges think is the greatest of the Roman historians. He is somebody who was rediscovered in the Renaissance and was immensely popular for the next 500 years as somebody with a real grasp of power, imperial power, tyranny, how it works. He was particularly popular in the Enlightenment for thinking about contemporary politics. And Tacitus is, just to give you the brief summary, he's born probably in around 59 AD.
Okay.
We don't know where he's from, but he's probably not an Italian from the main bits of Roman Italy. If he is from Italy, it's from the very north of Italy, but he might also be from somewhere like Provence, from southern Gaul. And he is born into the up-and-coming upper classes. His father may be a provincial administrator. He has a training in rhetoric in Rome and is one of the most famous advocates, lawyers, and of his generation. He joins the Senate, and it's in the year 100 that he becomes consul, the highest traditional republican magistracy. He becomes consul in the middle of the year because under the emperors they switch consuls. They don't just have two consuls a year, they have consuls every few months so that you can give more of the senators the feeling that they are really reaching the pinnacle. But he has a distinguished career, and his writing career starts just before his consulship. And the really important thing that happens is has got to do with the emperors that he's writing under. And as far as he claims, that's the thing that really has the impact on his work. So the emperors, while he was growing up, when he was maybe 9 years old, the Emperor Nero, the last of the first dynasty, the Julian and Claudian dynasty of Rome, is forced to commit suicide. And you have a year of civil war, the year of the four emperors, with claimants to the throne coming from all over the place, from Spain, from Germany, from Syria and Egypt. And so you've got a sort of a remarkable moment of ferment, and then you have this stable dynasty, the so-called Flavian dynasty, with the Emperor Vespasian, who was the Roman commander in the East under Nero, who introduced a period of relatively stable government, and his son Titus, and then Titus's younger brother Domitian. And Domitian is one of the classic bad emperors of Roman history, and it's under Domitian that Tacitus has a shining career. He joins the Senate, he is appointed to various magistracies, he is he's working for example on Domitian's great great secular games, the games that are only supposed to happen once a century or so. He's somebody who does well in the times, which are later condemned as the absolute the terrible time for the Senate, because under Domitian there are various conspiracies and treason trials resulting from the conspiracies, and perhaps conspiracies because there are these treason trials and senators being tried and executed. And then Domitian is murdered, and the Senate breathes a sigh of relief, and they put an elderly senator, Nerva, on the throne in 96. And, you know, they choose him because he's old and not particularly strong, and he's a good intermediate candidate, but he's not really very well able to control the situation. And soon there's a sort of coup in which he is forced to adopt the governor of Germany, who is the later Emperor Trajan, who of course is away in Germany, and they never actually meet after the adoption, but that secures the succession. And Trajan, of course, is an immensely successful military and civilian emperor. He doesn't need to execute senators, and so everybody loves him. Doesn't mean that he is a doesn't mean that he's a pushover, but he's somebody that everybody can get behind.
I want to Gavin, and I want to get there with probably near the end to kind of speak more about maybe Trajan and the lasting legacy that
Well, in that case, I won't say anything about that.
No, it's okay. Yeah, you've laid out the land really good. I want to unpack a few of the comments that you shared here. So we have the kind of the context for the conversation. So you made a comment, the Enlightenment age. Why is I think you said age or era, but you said Enlightenment. Why do historians call the period of time that Tacitus lived, or a part of that period of time, the Enlightenment age?
When I'm talking about the Enlightenment, I am talking about how the readers of Tacitus in especially 18th century Europe. I'm talking about his period of peak of peak popularity. So I'm talking about the readership of Tacitus, because that's the time at which he's seen as the ultimate philosophical historian, the model for people like Edward Gibbon. So that was what I was getting at there. But, you know, Gibbon, who loved Tacitus, thought that this age that began with the murder of Domitian and the Nerva and then Trajan, that was the happiest period of human history. So there is a connection there. Tacitus affected how people thought about his own times, because he wrote about the previous times, the times up to the murder of Domitian, and he made them out to be pretty bad. And he is very always careful to compliment the rulership of his own times, whether that's what he felt, whether he really was happy with the current regime, we don't know, because he wouldn't have said if he wasn't, because that wasn't very wise. So that's the murder of Domitian is, I think, the crucial turning point. And that is the moment after which Tacitus, who's had his great rhetorical training, starts his writing career.
Okay. Do we, and I know there's limited records of his early age. So just let us know what's known and not known. You mentioned his father. Do we know anything about his mother?
I do not think that we do know anything about his mother. We know about his wife.
Okay.
Who was the daughter of a governor of Britain, Agricola. And that is the moment, you know, that is what, as it were, one of the works he launches his career with is the life of his father-in-law and his seven-year term as governor of Britain. And so that's one of the contexts that we know of in his life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to name one other contact who's not a family member, but a friend, who I think is also important. This is really, again, in the period after the death of Domitian, but this is Pliny the Younger, Gaius, Caecilius Plinius, Secundus Pliny the Younger, who is a letter writer who wrote a collection of letters in 10 books in the reign of Trajan, and Tacitus is his star correspondent to write letters to. And he's a man of a little bit younger than Tacitus, and maybe he is consul a couple of years later. And I've just remembered, I actually gave you earlier the wrong date for when
it's okay, correct Tacitus it. Yeah, that's fine. Consul. Yeah. What's the date?
I told you 100, and that's the date that Pliny was consul. Tacitus was consul in 98, so he's about 2 years. He's about 2 years between them. Mm-hmm. So Pliny gives us lots of letters to Tacitus, and Pliny is never happier than when he meets somebody in the circus, and a man asks him, do I know you? And he says, well, you probably know of me from my writings. And that's Pliny's answer. The man says, you must be either Pliny or Tacitus. So the fact that Pliny is named alongside Tacitus as a famous writer is something that really cheers Pliny up. So he's the main connection among his contemporaries that we know of. And I can't remember quite how many letters there are to Pliny from Pliny to Tacitus in the collection, but there are about 10. And they are, including some that are addressed to him, giving him material for his histories. So he's the other main person that we know of.
So someone that is a prolific writer, why do you think that... and this is probably part of the answer is probably interpretive, or your opinion. Why do you think there's a lack of writing about his early life if he's such a prolific writer as an adult?
Well, I think that there are two elements here. One is that he is not he's not an autobiographical writer.
Mm-hmm.
The other is, I think, rather that it's about the sheer selectiveness of information that we actually have from antiquity, the sheer amount that's simply lost. But I think it's also the case that Pliny is interested in having lots of letters to Tacitus in his letter collection that he puts together. Mm-hmm. Because Tacitus is famous. If he'd lived 20 years younger, earlier, he wouldn't have included all those letters to Tacitus, because Tacitus wouldn't have been famous then. Mm. So I think it's just a general problem about antiquity that we very often don't know about people's early years, and often what we do know is, you know, what you find in biographies can be slightly, you're not really sure whether it's true or not. Well, there's no biographical tradition for Tacitus. Nobody seems to have done what he did for his father-in-law, Agricola. So it's just one of those cases where our knowledge comes from, since it's the odd little things that he lets slip in his work, from the letters of Pliny, and occasionally there are things like inscriptions that will tell us little, you know, bits of career details, but they're very, very hard to get any sense of the inner life, as it were, or of the family life.
Yeah, and you said his father-in-law was a governor of Britain. So in Britain at that time, so we're around roughly first century, second century, AD. Yeah.
The governorship is probably 77 to 84, but there's some debate on the exact dates, but around about 80 AD.
Yeah, and would they have been speaking Latin at that point in time in Britain, or a different language?
This is one of the things that is described in the biography of his father-in-law, is the process that of Romanization, to use a controversial but rather inevitable word. It's what happens in a place like Britain. You know, it was conquest began in 43 AD, so it's been conquered for just over 30 years when his father-in-law takes over. And his father-in-law had actually been involved at earlier stages, had served in Britain before. And Tacitus describes how, among the strategies that you use, you build the bathhouses, you give them luxuries, you give them a literary education in Latin. So I think the answer is that there would have been Roman colonists there who would have spoken in Latin. There would have been British chiefs, aristocrats, who knew that if they wanted to keep their positions at the, you know, their positions of leadership, that they did actually need to know Latin. Of course, they would probably have known some Latin even before the invasion. So it's a case of a colonial society where you've got, you've definitely got groups who know Latin, and that would certainly be the only language that Agricola would have worked in when he was governor of Britain. But one of the ironies here is that Agricola marches north. He tries to conquer more and more of the island. He marches into what's now Scotland, and has a last desperate battle at Mons Graupius, desperate, that is, for the Britons. And Tacitus gives us two speeches before the battle, one from Agricola and one from the British leader, who is called Calgicus. And this is a very, very famous speech as a condemnation of Roman imperialism, written by the son-in-law of the man who defeated Calgicus, who conquered nearly all of Britain. It's a quote that you may have heard. They make a wilderness and they call it peace. And that, I think, is a very, and it's a piece of fine Latin rhetoric put in the mouth of somebody who certainly wasn't speaking to his troops in Latin. And it's certainly not something that that Agricola himself had heard. It may be that there never was such a speech. There probably wasn't. But it's a semi-fictional way of expressing ideas about Roman colonialism and about freedom. And the great irony of it, or the problem that really obsesses Tacitus, is that his barbarian commander says, "We are the last free Britons. We are making sure that there's a bit of us that is still free. And of course, for the Roman senators, like Tacitus, were also obsessed with freedom. But for them, freedom was a slogan that was used to refer to what happened before you had an emperor. So to the republic that had existed before the emperor. So there's a great nostalgia for freedom, but also an awareness that the Romans are who are themselves nostalgic for political freedom are taking away, as it were, national freedom from other people by conquering them. And that, I think, is one of the tensions that's very interesting there. So Britain would have been a, you know, pretty rough place with lots of building works going on. It was a job that his father-in-law had because he was a good soldier. He would have had lots of troops to look after, and he was put in office for a good long time for a provincial governor of 7 years because they wanted to get they wanted somebody who was reliable and who would conquer ever more of the island.
Okay. In addition to Latin, would there have been an earlier form of English being spoken in Britain at that point?
No, there would have been. There'd have been a Celtic language for which we really have limited surviving evidence because of the success of the Roman colonization. And that is the pattern really across Western Europe when the Romans invaded Latin spoken in the towns and Latin on inscriptions, the things that remain, and the native languages being spoken mainly at the fringes.
Okay. What languages then? So Tacitus has a father-in-law in Britain. He grows up in Rome, presumably most of his career is in Rome. Do scholars know what languages he would have specifically been fluent in and wrote in?
We don't know, but we assume that as an upper-class Roman, he would have learnt good Greek. That would have been an important part of his training, and that would have been, we don't know how good, we don't know if he mm-hmm. would have been a convincing writer of Greek if he turned to it, but all his works are in Latin, and that is, and that's very much typical, I think, of the Roman aristocracy, that they, for them, there are very much two languages, and other languages are really barely mentioned.
There's no reason to think that he knew Celtic?
I think it's pretty unlikely because there's no evidence that he himself was actually in Britain. We don't.
Okay.
It's perfectly possible he went, but we don't know that. It's funny because in very close to where I live, there is the National Gallery of Scotland, and there you can see from the late 19th century a picture of famous early Scots, and you've got Calgacus, the man giving the speech, there, and you have got next to him Agricola, and then Tacitus carrying a notepad. This is a late 19th century mural, but in fact, we don't know that Tacitus ever came.
Interesting. Do scholars know what his religious orientation was?
There's a lot of debate about this, because he is somebody who can seem immensely cynical. Now, he was a perfectly conformist politician. You expect he just got on with Roman traditional Roman religion, and indeed he was a priest. He held a priesthood, and this priesthood doesn't imply anything about religious commitment. It's just something that aristocrats do well under on the when they want to get ahead. He was a quindicimvir, he is also notable as one of the first writers to mention Christianity in Latin, though slightly later than his friend Pliny. He does describe the persecution of the Christians in Rome under Nero after the great fire of Rome, when Nero, some people blamed Nero, and Nero blamed the Christians and made them into human torches and had horrific horrific games where the Christians were punished for their alleged crime, but he's not particularly sympathetic. He also knows about Judaism. There's a section of his histories where he talks about the Jews just at the around the time of the Jewish revolt and capture of Jerusalem. It's interesting, and he has more of a sense of what Judaism is like than he does what Christianity is like, but not, shall we say, sympathetic.
Hmm. Do you get a sense in his writings that he personally had an orientation towards a particular religion?
Well, the only religion would be traditional Greco-Roman paganism, and there's quite a lot of scholarly debate about his attitude to religion. Does he think that essentially does he by implication tie divine causation into the histories? I think that the traditional answer would be you can't really, would be not obviously. He doesn't really explain things particularly through religion, but I think that's a general problem with how you look at the role of Greco-Roman paganism in ancient people's lives. He's somebody who I think is often read as quite cynical, as quite as fundamentally full of doubt, I wouldn't say he's very imbued with religion.
Yeah, and I actually you answered one of my questions, which was great in your answer, because I was going to ask if you felt his religion and myths influenced his writings at all, but it sounds like the answer is very little or not at all.
Well, religion and myths are part of his they're part of his formation. They're part of his way of thinking, but he is he's a historian who has satisfied modern people that he is a historian, even if he isn't really a historian like a modern historian, in terms of he's not actually that scientific. He's perfectly willing to bend chronology for artistic purposes. He is perfectly willing to have fake speeches, so he's in that sense he's a typical ancient historian. But I think it's partly because of what survives of his writings. He's dealing with his own times, and so what he's giving us is his own account of those times. So religion, perhaps, there is interesting writing being done about his religious thought, but it's certainly not something that he's trying to demonstrate in his writing.
I read that he had a style of brevity in his writing, in his prose. Do you agree with that assertion? And if so, what does that mean?
That's a very good characterization. And it's a simple characterization, but it's true. He is somebody who writes in a way that's quite notable for epigrammatic point. That is to say, I gave you that line, they make a wilderness and they call it peace. And in Latin, it's just five words. It's a very effective piece of rhetoric. You get it. That there's no. It's very much the opposite of, say, another Latin writer, famous and influential Latin writer, more influential, Cicero, who is famous for his long sentences. Tacitus does have quite long sentences sometimes, but the bits he's famous for are those little things that catch an idea, the little he's perfectly happy to leave out verbs, leave out the verb to be, which is a thing you can do in Latin. So, and it abbreviates, it shortens the sentence. So I think that is a good characterization. It's not everything that he's about. And in one of his works, the Dialogue on Orators, he is actually writes much more like Cicero. But when he was writing history, he's punchy and epigrammatic.
In the archives, how much writings exist from Tacitus, if you were to describe it in terms of like integer type numbers, quantities?
Okay, well, we have three short works from early in his career. The Dialogue mentioned, the Biography of Agricola, and the Germania, which is about Germany. And those are each one scroll. So a scroll would be like maybe 30 pages of a modern paperback, maybe a bit more. So not particularly long. His major historical works, there were two works. There was the Histories, which started from that war, the famous war of his childhood, the Year of the Four Emperors, the Civil Wars, and went down to the murder of Domitian. And when he'd finished the Histories, which was probably in 12 books, some people think there might have been 14, he went backwards and he wrote the Annals, which were probably in 18 books, though some people think 16. We know 30 in total, but we don't know where the gaps exactly, the distribution, because some of them have been lost in transmission. And so reading Tacitus, it's full of gaps. So we have his history of his annals, which are the second historical work, but first in time, start with the death of the first Emperor Augustus in 14, and they carry on until the year 29, and then there's a sudden gap in the manuscript, and you come back 2 years later in 31, you go from 31 to 37, and then you have lost another 4.5 books dealing with the Emperor Caligula and the beginning of the reign of the Emperor Claudius, and you have the end of the reign of the Emperor Claudius and the first 12 years of Nero, but you don't have the last 2 years of Nero. So it's full of gaps, and the Histories, the first of his two historical works, but the one that is later in time, begins after Nero's death, but it only, in the five books we have, he's mainly talking about the great civil war of the year 69, and so we don't have what he had to say about the rest of the reign of Vespasian and Vespasian's sons, Titus and Domitian. And Domitian, of course, would have been particularly interesting because that was the moment, as it were, that stimulated him. So I am trying to just think how many books there actually are of those 18. By my maths, it's around about, we've got around about 15 books of the 30 books, and this is book in the sense of, you know, 30, 40 paperback pages. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can get it in three modern books. That's the one of which will be quite small, and one of which will be quite chunky, and one of which will be somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, okay, interesting. Was he being commissioned to produce some or all of these works? Asked another way, how was he making sustenance? How was he making a living?
I think he was a senator, and in order to be a senator, you had to be a millionaire. I mean, literally a millionaire, you had to have a million sesterces. I suspect that he would have got most of it through inheritance, including from his father-in-law, as well as his own parents. And he practiced at the bar. And he, in his late life, he was governor of Asia, which is the province of Asia is basically the coast of Turkey on the Aegean Sea, and it's one of the richest provinces in the Roman Empire. And in various ways, being a provincial governor was probably fairly lucrative. So you didn't make money from writing in the ancient world, because obviously the production costs of everything being copied by hand, usually whether by people who were doing it as slaves or people who were doing it to earn money, you know, you can't produce books themselves are very expensive, and you probably don't have many copies, so you can't make a huge amount out of that. He doesn't mention any patrons as such, and that's, I think, that's a cultural thing, which is that historians aren't supposed to have patrons, because as a historian you're supposed to be you're supposed to be independent. So he's somebody with his own resources, and who is claiming to be essentially exercising his independent judgment.
Okay, so how does historians like yourself, Gavin, and colleagues, how do you look at the veracity of his writings? On one hand, you spoke about there seems to be signs that he took a more impartial approach to his writings. On other hand, there's Roman emperors that I presume may read his works at that given time. How does a historian kind of approach his writings from that veracity, historicity perspective?
Well, one of the things that you can do is you can compare it to other things that survive, whether they are writings or whether they are things like inscriptions. And Tacitus does have an interesting relationship with inscriptions. So in his books on the Emperor Claudius, this is book, I think, 11 of the Annals, there is a speech about welcoming more people from Gaul, from what's now France, into the Senate. The Senate is expanding away from its traditional Italian background. This at the time was controversial. And Claudius's speech is recorded on a magnificent inscription in Lyon that survives to this day. And we can compare the speech in Tacitus's version and in Claudius's version. And he turns Claudius's style into his own, because that's what ancient historians do. So in a sense, he's, in one way, there are the changes that all ancient historians make, which modern historians would never, they'd never rewrite somebody's speech for stylistic purposes, but it shows that he is looking at sources. And there are places where you can see that he must have some sort of documentary sources in terms of records of the Senate is one thing that he's often been thought to have used. There was a case of another inscription, the Senatus Consultum de Pisona Patria, that's the Senate's judgment concerning Piso, the father, Gnaeus Piso, the father, the elder of Piso, that is. This is an inscription from 19 or 20 AD, just after a Roman aristocrat, Piso, has been condemned by the Senate for his opposition to and conceivably involvement in the death of the Emperor Tiberius's heir Germanicus. And it's a long, long inscription. And when it was discovered in, as I say, about 30 years ago, there were two things that became very obvious. One was that Tacitus had clearly looked up something like this. Either this very text, or he'd looked up documents that were very close to it. So you have strong confirmation. You could also see that he changed the chronology of the events of the year 19 AD for purposes of narrative, basically, so that he would tell the story of the death of the young prince Germanicus, and then the trial of his enemy. And Piso didn't kill Germanicus, but he had fallen out with him, and he behaved with incredible arrogance. So you have an event which gets confirmation from other sources. There are also things that you can compare to how they're narrated in, say, the biographer Suetonius, or the later Greek historian Cassius Dio. So sometimes we just have to rely on Tacitus, as it were, but we can tell that he's more or less trying to give us a version, a real version of events.
Okay.
The other thing which I would just quickly say is that the way he gets over emperors reading his material is he definitely doesn't write about the current emperors. So he probably couldn't have said the imperial system is terrible, all emperors are tyrants, but he can certainly say that dead emperors are tyrants.
Okay, interesting. And we probably don't have to spend much time on this, but I want to circle back to a comment you made earlier that he did a lot of work during Domitian's reign. Can you summarize the work that he did during Domitian's reign?
I've already mentioned some of the highlights. I mean, one of these is that he is appointed praetor, which is the main magistracy under below consulate. He is appointed a priest. De Kimvir. He's involved in the so-called secular games. That's the sort of once in a lifetime games, even though Domitian's games weren't once in a lifetime, because they'd happened less than 40 years before, but Domitian argued that Claudius had got the count wrong, so that they should happen now. So he's part of the regime. In around about 89 to 93. So that's Domitian's reign is from 81 to 96. So this is around about the really bad time of Domitian's reign as far as the senators are concerned. He's actually on service overseas and we don't know where he is. We know this because he tells us he wasn't there when his father-in-law Agricola died. So there's, as it were, he's just going through the normal stages of a senatorial career, ready to be appointed to the consulship that he in the end gets, and he is also presumably getting along with his legal practice.
What's known about his death?
Well, we don't really know about it. We know that the annals breaks off in the middle of a sentence, his last work. But what we don't know is whether it breaks off in the middle of a sentence because he died, or because simply, if you think about how, you know, ancient books are written, or perhaps early medieval books, as it may be, it's perfectly possible that sentence was just at the end of one, you know, gathering of pages. You know, you like just like modern books, or at least the ones that aren't just paperbacks with things stuck up. You know, you have bound gatherings of pages, and if at that point something sudden, you know, the last gatherings were simply lost in a monastery at some point. There's only one manuscript of the first that's survived of the first books of the annals, and another one of the later books of the annals and the histories. And it's a very tenuous survival of those books. And it's perfectly possible that simply at some point things were the end was lost. So we don't know whether he finished that. He probably died sometime in Hadrian's reign. Hadrian came to the throne in 117. Some people think that the annals show signs of having been written under Hadrian, and it's certainly possible. Pliny, his friend, was dead, so we don't get Pliny's obituary in his letters. Pliny would have included a letter in his published publication saying how sorry he was about Tacitus' death if he hadn't himself died, well, at least, probably at least 5 and maybe 10 or 15 years earlier. So it's just another of those things where we simply don't know the exact date.
Seeing a sentence not finished and wondering if he passed away while writing the sentence sounds to me like the epitome of a cliffhanger.
Yep. Well, it's the same with some other famous ancient historians. Thucydides is also just stops in the middle of a sentence. So, and in that case, we think he probably did die at that point. But with Tacitus, we just don't know.
Okay. A closing question. You mentioned earlier that some believe he is the greatest historian. I believe you use that term in quotes, from the Roman period. Why would that be?
Well, I think that one reason has got to do with the style. It's got to do with this extraordinary way of writing the epigrams. I think it's also because he's somebody who is he's very, very clever. He deals with issues that people care about. He deals with tyranny. He deals with how can you behave well under a tyranny? How can he is somebody with a great nostalgia for an idea of freedom and a republic. But it also seems fairly clear that he doesn't think that the republic is a, you know, it's not viable anymore. The way that things might work, there's a great moment in his dialogue where a character who appears to have old-fashioned Republican sympathies, Maternus, and they've been discussing why isn't oratory as good as it used to be. Says, you know, Cicero's oratory was great because there were enormous matters, huge controversies, a divided state. We're living when we're governed by just one man who is very wise. Liberty is the result of extreme license and disorder. So almost an argument that, well, yes, we have had to give up our freedom in order to be well governed. Did he believe this? The whole nature of the dialogue on orators is that he presents various views and we can't decide what they are. But I tend to think that that is rather what he thought, that he was reconciled to the imperial system, at least on a practical level. But this is very good for people in later periods to think with. But I think style is still the most important thing. It's just the most amazing read.
It's been enjoyable, Gavin, having you on the show and speaking about this important historical figure. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Again, everybody, Dr. Kelly's book that I referenced at the start of this episode that he co-authored, Two Romes, Rome and Constantinople in Late Antiquity. I'll drop a link to the book in the show notes on the IthacaBound.com's associated subpage to this episode. Gavin and everybody listening, as always, wishing you a marvelous journey. Bye for now.
Thanks very much, Andrew.
Hey again, if you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe to the podcast, and I wish you a bountiful rest of your day. Bye for now.